mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
We still spend a lot of time in this industry checking the checkers along the way. And so, you know, one of the things we think about at MSMO is the adoption at scale of standards should ultimately reduce the feeling that you need to check the checker that checks something before you. You should be able to rely on the data as it passes through the loan manufacturing process.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Today is February 2nd. I got a great show for you today. A lot going on. You've probably noticed a little bit of news around the Fed, so we'll talk about that in depth here in a moment. We'll also do a little bit of just a general market update. Had some interesting numbers that came out last week and some stuff to look forward to this week as well. We also had a very special guest coming up. Kevin and I will be interviewing Brian View, president of MSMO. MSMO is the mortgage industry standards organization, if you're not familiar with MSMO. So looking forward to a lively discussion with Brian about MSMO and what they do and how they are looking to work with all of us to continue improving the housing finance industry. Before we get into market update, just a little bit of data. OBMMI is still relatively low, even given the little bit of a sell-off on Friday. 6.06 is the conforming 30-year average rate that borrowers are locking in right now. The 10-year is up to 4.26, so still feeling a little bit of the pain of the Warsh appointment, or nomination, I should say, to lead the Fed. And again, we'll talk about that more in a minute. But that spread between treasuries and mortgages still continuing to shrink, 1.81 as of the most recent reading on Friday. So that's good. You know, anything below 2 has been great over the past couple of years. And as we get closer to 1.7, 1.6, really good news for mortgages, even as we see treasuries bounce a little bit and you know, get closer to 4.3, still seeing mortgages close to that 5 handle. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Let's go to check in with James and Alex, see what's going on in the market. Okay, let us get right into it and talk about the elephant in the room. So the long-awaited but not surprising nomination has been announced for the next chairman of the Fed. So market obviously reacted. We'll get to that here in a minute. A lot of history between the president and Warsh's family, which is interesting. Going back like to college. Anyway, I don't know where to start, but I'll start with Alex. What are your thoughts and just what's the general take from the markets right now on this nomination?
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin Warsh was the winner on the nominee for Federal Reserve Chairman. He beat out Hassett and Reeder. And he seems to be, I think Kevin Foley, who's been on the podcast a few times, put it pretty well. He's kind of being perceived as the safe pick. Hassett in particular, one of the other candidates, was seen as potentially continuing on the narrative of the independence of the Fed being whittled down. It was kind of viewed that Hassett might be a little too in Trump's pocket. He might be a little bit too aligned with where the administration wants to take the rate path. Warsh has an interesting career. He started on Wall Street like a lot of central bankers. He then transferred over to the public sector side beginning in 2006 during George W. Bush administration. He was one of the youngest, I think at the time, and maybe still is, the youngest appointee to the Board of Governors ever. He was really known for his deep Wall Street connections. Obviously, 2006 in the lead up to the financial crisis, he was kind of the conduit between the Federal Reserve and Wall Street. And obviously there was a lot of talking between the two going on during those years. You know, if you've ever read the book, like Too Big to Fail, they were in close communication 24 hours a day during like the depths of the crisis. And from my readings, you know, Ben Bernanke, who was the head of the Federal Reserve at the time, he and Warsh got along pretty well. And then as the presidential administrations transferred over from George W. Bush into Obama, Warsh was kind of the first to start raising red flags around, I think the Federal Reserve has done enough at this point. The economy seems to be on better footing than it was during the depths of the crisis. And in addition to that, he called on other stakeholders in Washington, namely Congress, to take on some more of this economic relief that needs to occur throughout the economy. He didn't want the Fed to be the only game in town, which, as history kind of shows, the Fed is the only game in town in a lot of cases. All that to say, he was pretty hawkish in 2011 when he left the Fed. He had said he was only going to stay for 5 years. He left on good terms. Like I said, he was on good terms with Bernanke, who was head at the time. Entered academia and all that. That's where he spent the rest of his time, really, just on boards and in academia in the interim period. And again, he was known as a hawk during all this time. In 2010, when the inflation rate was 10%, he was worried about inflation when the unemployment rate was 10%, which is what pretty much no one else was looking at the time. Fast forward to 2024, you know, the political winds are maybe changing a little bit as Trump is looking to win the presidency for a second time. And his tune seems to have changed a little bit. And I think this is what gives some people a little bit of pause in regards to Warsh. Is he seems to be pretty hawkish when a Democrat is in power. And then he, at least with what he's been saying like the last 12 to 18 months, he seems to be a little bit more dovish and open to cutting rates. Did that help him get the job? I mean, I don't think anyone that went into that job interview saying they were going to be hawkish was going to get the job. So I do think that there's a little bit of that there. But at the same time, you got to like read between the lines. And like Warsh has always been against quantitative easing. He's not necessarily against cutting of rates. So there's a large diversity of opinion out there right now about him. But at the end of the day, I do think he was the safe pick. And, you know, the markets might now be pricing in expectations for a higher rate path if he does stay on that, you know, global financial crisis mindset, with the potential for some more rate cuts. But again, he's not like the Hassett who was going to be in Trump's pocket and was going to call for rate cuts immediately.
Right. It's so interesting, like not unexpected, but still out of the three, maybe the least expected, right? When you say safe pick, you could also say on paper, like the least likely or the maybe for what we think policy, what we think the White House wants in terms of policy, probably the wrong pick, but also it could be part of the strategy to say, you know, with gold and silver rising and some of the worries out there of the, you know, trading away from America, that the independence of the Fed seemed to be slipping. And I think that the White House firmly knew that that was going to be a concern. Bringing in Warsh, I think, turns that attitude a little bit, or turns that perception, right? That's why we saw precious metals sell off on Friday and saw kind of this odd, I don't know, capitulation in the market, because this pick is on paper, again, looks more hawkish than the other possible picks. But at the same time, like you said, Warsh has moved with the tides a little bit, and he still will likely, based on his history with the president and his ties to the Trump family, will probably do the bidding of the White House, maybe not to the extent that Myron would or some others who have called for kind of ridiculous deep rate cuts, but it's likely he's going to be more aggressive maybe than Chairman Powell. He's also looking for a smaller Fed, which is an interesting thing. You mentioned, you know, QE. He was on board with QE1, and that was pretty much it. Then he said we went way too far to get into the many trillions, and there's good articles that are written about his stance on wanting a smaller Fed. Nobody has great plans to actually execute on that, but still it's a maybe something that goes along with the general Republican stance on monetary policy, that the Fed probably is way too bloated and we need something a bit smaller. Anyway, I want to hear from you too, James. I think you have some opinions on this nomination and whether it'll even go through too. We should talk about that here in a minute.
He's an interesting double-edged sword in that he's been critical of the Fed for years, right? So getting picked, getting in there, he comes and he's like, you've been doing this wrong. We need to cut rates. that doesn't actually swing out of tune, right? You could look at that and be like, oh, that might be some of the administration, but it also, well, he's been critical for a long time of the way we've been doing things. So it lines up with him. He also, though, has been very critical of quantitative easing. And so with Fannie and Freddie now going to buy $200 billion in bonds, right, out of the market, that is something that he probably wouldn't be for. So, hey, are we going to turn that hose back on? Warsh would probably push against that, and that would not be as liquid for the administration. So it's kind of an interesting pick there. He does face a challenge in the Senate with the banking committee. He needs to be confirmed. Tillis, one of the senators, has said, hey, I will not approve of any nomination until what is going on with Powell and Lisa Cook is kind of sorted out. We don't like seeing a hand stepping into the Fed so heavily. So we have to figure this out before we can do the nomination or the actual approval. Now that he's on the short list or the pick list, it's kind of anyone's game as to whether he'll make it. Alex and I, we were all talking beforehand. I don't think he will drop out anytime soon, although there was a little bit of speculation around that just because of the market. Gold and silver kind of reacted poorly. But looking at it, you know, give it a few weeks, months. We have until May. We have until May with Powell leaving or set to leave. Kick it a few months, see what goes on with the DOJ, and then I think he'll get approved.
Gotcha. So I've heard the same speculation that if rates continue climbing, because there was a rate reaction on Friday too, if you see the Treasury rate get up to, you know, start nearing 4.5%, that that mood of the market might cause him to drop out, and that might again be part of the strategy. Like there's a little bit of a speculation that he's a sacrificial lamb, which I wouldn't think he would do intentionally or consciously, but possibly that's part of the strategy as well. So this nomination gets blocked. There's more back and forth between the White House, Congress, and the DOJ. You have to think eventually, if those threats hold, that these charges get dropped, which President Trump could do with the wag of a pen, right? But again, there's this, they're each kind of taking a page out of each other's books with these threats to basically go nuclear in state policy that's more preferential to the White House or to get someone nominated or not nominated. So it's been interesting to see that back and forth. Interesting times. And we will see how it plays out here over the next few months, as you said, because once we get towards May, Powell should leave if there's a new chairperson. But if there is not a new chairperson, Powell continues to be in the seat. And as you can tell from the rhetoric and the social media, like that's the last thing that in our industry that Bill Pulte wants. It's the last thing that Donald Trump and the rest of the administration want, because it does feel like the Fed is standing in the way of their policy needs, even though it's seemingly unlikely that no matter who gets confirmed, that there's going to be much of a change in the direction of the Fed funds rate.
I think Kevin Foley put it best. I know I've quoted him twice now, but you know, this pick over the other two being far more dovish picks, you know, this one was one to appease those worried about Fed independence. And we might see Warsh used as a punching bag, for lack of a better term, by the Trump administration in similar ways that Powell has been. You know, there'll be a little bit of friction between the two, but as Trump said, he's straight out of central casting, and you know, I'm sure he'll play his role well. So,
and between him and Powell, I did think it was an interesting anecdote that if we cut back to 2018, we look at who was the final two picks for Fed chair, it was Powell and it was Warsh. So, you know, if at first you don't succeed, right, try and try again. It's a story of success for him. He might finally make this cut, but they're not too similar. They're not too different.
Right. Yeah. And again, deep ties personally, which is an interesting thing to keep in mind. I mean, none of it's speculative. It's all very public that their families go way back, and Donald Trump himself and Kevin Warsh go back quite a bit. So we will see how that works out. But yeah, it is likely that once he gets in that seat and realizes which he already knows, the gravity of that position, he will need to push back a little bit versus play the dovish card and risk again having that trade come on, or that worry in the entire globe that the Fed has been compromised in terms of its independence from politics. a lot to think about. Keep your eye on that story, gang. I mean, nothing different to do, I would say, in terms of strategy. I mean, whether you're hedging or your originator lock and loans, mortgage rates have not reacted huge to this news, but certainly could. But it doesn't feel like, again, feels like this is somewhat calculated. There's still some stability here that'll work itself out over the next couple of weeks, but we'll keep you apprised, and we'll have a special episode if something really gets out of hand. But I'd look for, I'd watch the 10 years, especially. You see that 10 year continue to drift up. I'm not sure if that was part of the strategy. So there might be a reaction there. So kind of dwarfed by that conversation, there are some other things going on. There was a Fed meeting last week. Anything notable from that meeting that you gentlemen would bring to this discussion?
Nothing massive. I think the market as a whole was far more focused on other realms, what Trump was going to do with his nomination and such. If you didn't know, there was no rate change there. Maybe the biggest change was, I mean, Powell in the press briefing, kind of said the economy's on solid footing, mainly on the back of business earnings and the AI boom. And then we saw Myron in particular, he kind of softened his stance on how dovish he was. He's been voting for 50 basis points, as we know. He's kind of been a loner doing that. But this time around, he voted for a 25 basis point cut along with Waller. Waller did the same back in for the last meeting last year as well. But it maybe shows a bit of a softening in this dovish position that maybe we aren't. The economy isn't in the doldrums that Myron said it was when he first came in. On the topic of Myron, his official posting ended January 31st. Again, he was just coming in to cover the remainder of Kugler's term. But there's still no word on his replacement. And from what I can tell, he will stay in that position until, much like Powell, until a successor is confirmed. So I was thinking maybe Trump might do a double nomination. He might say Warsh and someone else to replace Myron. But for the time being, it just seems like Myron's going to stay in that role, again, indefinitely until a replacement is found. But that's really all there was from this particular meeting.
Okay, good. Yeah, as you said, jobs market has not broken yet. The economy does seem like it is, again, just resilient, just seems invincible compared to some, against some of the headwinds right now. But also seeing some inflation, which kind of goes against, some of those votes as well. Like PPI was a little bit hot last week, wasn't it?
Correct. Yeah, it came in. It was supposed to be 0.2, 0.3%, I believe, and it came in at 0.5% month over month. That dragged the year over year reading up to 3%. That's the first time we've had a 3% reading on an inflation metric in a number of months now. And the core number was 3.5% for year over year. And just remember that PPI is the prices that producers are paying. So it kind of tends to front run the prices that consumers will see when producers, if they choose to pass those prices on, pass them on to the consumer, which they're probably apt to do. So we could see a spike in CPI coming down the pipeline here. There's not a huge indication of what particularly spiked the PPI this time around. Although, I have been seeing, analysis that those warehouses that were very full this time last year that were front running tariffs are pretty empty. And so obviously imports have to continue. We might be seeing some delay to those tariffs as we've drawn down the inventory we had domestically that was acquired prior to the tariffs. And now we're maybe beginning to see the price of tariffs. But keep an eye on that. Again, it's just one reading and it was just slightly hot. But again, 3% is not where we would like to be.
Right. It does match up with some of the narrative we've had on this podcast. And James, I think you've mentioned this more than once that, if we don't see a corresponding number in the CPI, meaning we don't see a corresponding bump in prices for the consumer, we continue to see a little bit of just margin tightening, right? That the producers are kind of eating the effects of tariffs, which, again, on paper, are not turning out to be anywhere near the actual notional rates of these tariffs, right? 10, 20, 30%. We're talking about slightly high inflation, right? Finally seeing a three handle on the number, but 3.5 with core, meaning something's coming through the pipe that's increasing prices, and it likely is related to tariffs that are a little bit delayed because of inventory drawdown. But so far, the consumers is paying a lot less of that, right? We're seeing CPI between 2.5 and 3.
Yeah, I definitely think that this is kind of a sign of that. I was digging into PPI earlier last week, and it's mostly services. Goods was actually flat month to month. So services is what kicked us up throughout the course of December to January. It was, you know, food and alcohol, health and beauty, those kind of luxury products. So I, you know, another theme that we talk about on this podcast a lot has been that K-shaped economy that, you know, food is, of course, everyone, but these services that might be a little bit more luxury, a little bit more, you don't have to spend on it, that is seeing some upward pressure. It's not quite all the goods are coming up as the tariffs like wind down the warehouses, but it is the producers who are eating costs as we continue to see.
All right. That's a good pull. Yeah. The luxury item issue, maybe there's a little more willingness to pay more there. There's a little less pressure downward on prices. And it does support the narrative of a K-shaped recovery where, yeah, you kind of unfortunately have the haves, you know, doing a bit better, quite a bit better than the have-nots in terms of just mainly based on assets, right? And just how much asset appreciation there's been over the last 5 years or so with the liquidity that was dumped into the markets. All right. I think that's about it, gang. Very good discussion. Everybody out there, definitely continue paying attention to what happens with this nomination and any potential drama around it as it relates to some of the threats around the DOJ and confirmation and votes. Otherwise, keep your eyes on the numbers as always and some geopolitics as well. Obviously, a little bit of drama around Iran this week. So look for headlines on that. And we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks a lot, Alex. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. We have a rare event today. We have a special guest 2 weeks in a row. He may need no introduction to those in the mortgage industry, but just in case, Kevin and I are here with Brian View. Brian is president of MSMO. MSMO is the mortgage industry standards organization. MSMO's mission is fairly straightforward and extremely valuable and important, I'd say. It's to make the entire housing finance ecosystem more efficient, more transparent, and connected. That's certainly a concept that's near and dear to us at Optimal Blue. I think we can all agree that the cost to produce a loan has soared over the years, and companies like MSMO and Optimal Blue have similar goals in terms of pushing back on those increases by creating better tech, better processes. So we're super excited and curious to have Brian here today. Welcome, Brian View.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, glad to be here. Really excited to be with Optimal Blue. I want to talk a little bit about my history with the platform because I think you are one of the groundbreaking technologies in the mortgage ecosystem. And truly, when I think about like the consumer benefit from all the tech that we consume as lenders, when the first version of Optimal Blue, which drawn a blank on the first product name, Blue something, right? It was Optimal Blue. Well, wasn't there a founding product name in the early days?
Oh, there was Solon. Solon was the early one. Yes.
There you go.
Yes, before the merger, of course. The
early 2000s. All the way back to the Solon days. And when I think about the impact of pricing transparency and granularity, yes, it benefits lenders from a margin management perspective, but ultimately I do truly believe it's led to lower costs and rates for consumers at the street level. So big fan of Optimal Blue all the way back to the early Solon days. And again, excited to be here with you guys.
That's awesome. No, I would totally agree with you there, Brian. I think transparency and that accuracy gives you just that opportunity to find the exact right product and price for a borrower. So I appreciate you acknowledging that. And just for, you know, for our listeners now who may not be familiar with MSMO, can you share a little bit about the MSMO system and what the organization does more specifically for our industry?
For sure. And I'm 4 months in and my team will, you know, they scold me every time I say it, but you know, I'll use the new guy card every now and again. I'm learning, you know, still four plus months into this, every day I'm uncovering new things for me that happen inside of the MSMO community. We use the word community intentionally. You know, Kevin and I met at a summit before I was officially onboarded last summer. It was kind of what led to Optimal Blue becoming a member of MSMO and as well as a sponsor. You guys really stepped up and have helped the MSMO community by being a summit series sponsor. So we truly appreciate the partnership, the membership, and the relationship. But Mizmo serves the entire mortgage ecosystem, right? So there's not a place in our ecosystem where Mizmo is not having impact. We're the mortgage industry standards maintenance organization, as you said, Jim. A year ago, I knew like two of the letters in that acronym. And so I think my experience is not too dissimilar from many in the industry. A lot of people are familiar with the name Mizmo, but very few people, frankly, understand the breadth and depth of what happens in the community. So at any given time, inside the Mizmo community, there's 30-ish work streams that are happening. And those work streams are not managed by Mizmo employees. There's only six of us, by the way, in no Mizmo kidding. Proper. Those work wow. streams are managed by the community, the industry. So we have hundreds of subject matter experts across all facets of the mortgage ecosystem that come together and form these work groups. And these work groups get formed when somebody in the industry brings a problem statement to Mizmo. And, you know, they say something like, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could standardize this data set in order to better connect these technologies in the tech stack, right? Or to improve the quality of a loan as it goes through the manufacturing process by having a standard set of data and definitions and labels that stay consistent through that entire loan cycle. So the work that gets done comes from the industry in the form of a problem statement. And then the work group kind of assembles around that problem statement and spends months, sometimes years, to create what becomes a standard. And for 26 years, Mizmo has been doing this work. There's somewhere in the magnitude of 200-ish standards that have been created and are maintained in some state through the Mizmo model. So yeah, we are, sadly at times, we're the best kept secret. And opportunities like this on your podcast really help us raise awareness for the value that Mizmo creates. So thank you again.
Of course. No, that was very succinct. Good kind of explanation of what the Mizmo community can do. And obviously a super efficient business on its own, being only six people within Mizmo, yeah. Mizmo proper.
Absolutely. And, you know, Brian, I've been familiar with Mizmo for a while and use Mizmo in a lot of ways in a product management capacity in the past. But, you know, I was having a conversation with someone, I think last year, who's in real estate tech. There is no Mizmo of, you know, real estate transactions in the same way, you know, that there is for mortgage. And, you know, it got me thinking about these background processes or this background infrastructure that helps keep things moving and helps kind of improve or, you know, allow us to take advantage of, you know, the way things are today. I would point out another similarity, which would be, you know, the conventional mortgage in the US, which we've talked a lot about in this podcast, and helping with MBS liquidity, which helps keep rates down. And, you know, it really powers the whole ecosystem. I would put Mizmo really right up there with that, because it what you guys are doing helps decrease the friction between transactions as loans move between multiple, you know, sometimes even dozens of counterparties having to hit, you know, each individual service that's required to close a loan. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, as we're getting into 2026, what kind of things are you all focused on going into this year? What are some of your top priorities to help keep the gears moving?
Yep. I'm going to come back to that because you hit something that I think is a good double click for the audience. So when you talk about, you know, the conventional loan, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Fannie Freddie kind of loan set, if you will, right? Just about everybody, you guys for sure, are familiar with the U's, right? All the uniform ba-ba-ba-ba-ba's that exist within Fannie and Freddie, right? So you have the URLA, the Uniform Residential Loan Application, the UAD, the Universal Uniform Appraisal Data Set, the UCD, the Closing Data Set. All those U's are built on the Mizmo model. So like there is no fungibility between Fannie and Freddie without those U's, right? And so you talk about margin management, best execution. There's no better example than what happens with, you know, loans that you can, you know, best X against Fannie and Freddie. And a big reason why that works so efficiently is because of those U's. I think there's a dozen standards within the Uniform Mortgage Data Program, UMDP. I'm learning all these acronyms like on the fly. So, you know, that's a great, great example of like real life every single day, you know, every capital markets desk, every trader is touching MSMO one way or the other, whether they know it or not. Right. So that's, I want to make sure we hit on that.
Yeah. That's a huge light bulb. That was a huge light bulb for me. You know, the GSEs have operated separately for many, many years, even though they've been under conservatorship. So it makes sense, especially when they move to a unified security. And even before that, this is a good example of, like you said earlier, the industry comes to MSMO and says, listen, this has to be easier. These two entities are separate and they are slightly different, but what we are delivering to them is fungible. It's exactly the same thing. How can we make it simpler in our own organization to not have to have two different work streams to deliver loans and have them guaranteed by these two agencies?
And then before I get to the real question, you'll get that a lot in this podcast, guys. I'm like chasing squirrels here.
I love it. I love it.
No, this is great.
Kevin, you probably saw at the summit in Boston, Fannie and Freddie had representatives on stage at one point during the main, you know, the session, the day of sessions. And they at every summit, they provide updates on what's going on with the U's. And that our most recent summit a couple weeks back down in Florida, they talked a lot about, you know, updates, and probably one of the more exciting updates coming out of the U's is around the universal appraisal data set, the 3.6 version, which really was built to set up the modernization of the entire appraisal framework built around all the data that goes into an appraisal. That UAD 3.6 is in production phase, which is a optional voluntary production phase. Lenders and AMCs and the like have the option to participate. There's several of those that are in it. And then it goes into a mandated phase in Q4 of 2026. So a lot of great feedback so far coming out of that release. And again, it's these standards help us to continue to modernize the loan manufacturing process, which ultimately is a better experience, lower cost for a consumer, which is a good segue for me to answer the question that was asked minutes ago now. So what are we really excited about in 2026? I would say there's two main things or themes that the community's focused on. There's 30 plus work groups. I've said that a couple times, and they're all important. We're not diminishing the importance of any of the work groups, but from a broad industry perspective, there's two initiatives that are really a focal point here as we, you know, kind of plow our way through Q1. The Mortgage Compliance Dataset, MCD, is the newest standard that's been published. Version 2.0 was published in December. The Mortgage Compliance Dataset is an example of a standard that has been created. It took almost 3 years for this standard to get published, because there's a whole governance process around standards, starting when the work order or the work request comes in. There's vetting that happens through governance to determine, is there a there, as they say, right? And then there's all kinds of steps through the process before the standard becomes the standard. Sounds like the former Steelers coach, I think he said that. To put it in perspective, the mortgage compliance data set is going to significantly help mortgage lenders, specifically in their legal compliance departments, better manage how they produce data for the auditors, for the regulators. In particular, this is going to benefit mostly the state regulated, you know, non-bank IMBs, if you will. And so imagine a 40 state IMB. Today, they could potentially have 40 unique data requests that come in when each state's preparing for their audit. And the CSBS, the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, which is the trade association for all of the state regulators. The CSBS, based on feedback from their members, the states, came to MSMO 3+ years ago with this problem statement. The states want to come up with a standard that can be shared across states, which will help technologists invest in building a tool that's not a one-off 50 times over, but rather, you know, a single tool that all states can participate in. And potentially there's a bigger play longer term within the CSBS to kind of advance their mission around one company, one exam. So multi-state lenders could rely on one exam, maybe from their home state, and then the results could be shared with other states. All of this is really, it was something that I saw right away when I came in as like massive value for a lender. And so connecting the dots between why MSMO matters to a lender and why they should participate both within the work groups, but also economically, why lenders should participate economically through the innovation investment fee, which is how lenders become members of MSMO. This was like the tangible standard that I think every lender can kind of say, I spend X dollars in legal and compliance, and, you know, some subset of those dollars are spent assembling and tracking down data as requests come in from the various states. We've had lenders tell us that, you know, based on their size and the number of states they're audited in, that once this is fully adopted, you know, at scale across the states, this could allow them to reallocate either a full FTE or maybe a third of an FTE and put those resources on like real risk mitigation exercises versus data collection. So wow, real tangible ROI. So MCD has been like the talk of summits, the last few summits, and we're really making a lot of progress there. And then I'll say the other big talk across the MSMO community is AI. I think everybody's talking about AI. And if you think about, you know, AI, machine learning, any model, it's only as good as the data that goes into it, right? And so, you know, as our industry, you know, I think we're still in the first inning as it relates to AI in our industry. Some would say that the national anthem hasn't even been played yet. Sure. But we're still very early, and MSMO is playing a key role in partnership with the Mortgage Bankers Association, specifically the Residential Board of Governors, RESBOG, to help design a framework for the industry around responsible use of AI in lending. And we'll use the same model that we use to create a standard where we bring all the cohorts to the table, you know, lenders, legal experts, obviously technology experts as we talk about AI, but also the regulator community, and kind of construct this framework that we can all kind of manage to so that we can advance the adoption of AI responsibly and safely from a risk management perspective. So those are kind of the two big themes you'll hear a lot about from MSMO.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, we've never, you know, the mortgage industry typically isn't known for early adoption, but the fact that we're, sounds like, you know, industry-wide a little bit ahead of the game. I know at OB, we certainly built a ton of features around AI, but for the whole industry to coalesce around some standards, I think makes a ton of sense, and where there's entire governments that haven't even broached that subject yet, but it needs to be kind of covered before this exponential growth that we've been warned about in AI happens and it gets a little bit out of control in terms of being able to make it more efficient and actually work for us. But then when you've got the first thing you mentioned, bringing together standardizations across states, I mean, I feel like that was an issue after the great financial crisis that made it difficult for some mortgage businesses to even stick around, because the legal fees and compliance were one of the things that ballooned after Dodd-Frank and all the extra regulation that came from, you know, some of it rightfully so, from the causes of the great financial crisis. And now we're probably overdue to get to the point where, yeah, it shouldn't matter how many states you do business in. There should be a standardized group of guidelines to help you answer regulators.
Yeah, I think one of the things that excited me about joining MSMO, you know, I'm a career mortgage banker, 30 36 years, we'll just say, long time. And I sat on the lender side for a lot, you know, a lot of those years, almost 30 years. And then I spent 6 years on the fintech partner vendor side before joining Mizmo. And, you know, what's been amazing and frustrating to watch happen is the cost to manufacture a loan has actually gone up as more technology has been introduced into our ecosystem. And so, and Jim, you kind of hit on it, a lot of it is the cost of compliance, right? The cost of risk management. And we still, I think we still spend a lot of time in this industry checking the checkers along the way. And so, you know, one of the things we think about at Mizmo is the adoption at scale of standards should ultimately reduce the feeling that you need to check the checker that checks something before you. You should be able to rely on the data as it passes through the loan manufacturing process. So I think that's kind of like that North Star that we think about is as the standards are adopted at scale, ultimately we need the whoever is the end decision maker, let's just say an investor downstream, we need them to get so comfortable with the data that they're seeing when it hits their desk, if you will, because they rely on the standards that the data kind of has been built to. And we're pushing towards that with every standard we create, but we still have standards that have been around for a while that we need to drive even more adoption. And so, you know, you'll hear a lot about awareness, adoption, and alignment coming from the team at Mizmo. And this is an opportunity to build awareness, and hopefully that awareness leads to some adoption increases as well.
Right. Full adoption, just to get away from some of that redundancy, right? Like redundancies to me is one of the biggest wastes of time in any industry.
That's a great point. And to tie both of those points together too, we follow a lot of the discourse around AI and, you know, some of the latest things that are being released and the things that people are talking about. And there's been, you know, a good amount of discussion of 2026 sort of being the year of vertical AI, where we're talking about AI deployed for specific use cases across specific industries and starting to become more effective. We've seen a lot of that already with coding. AI has gotten so much better at coding. And one of the key components that I've seen that help facilitate this, you know, vertical AI is the standards adoption. Do you have a clean, you know, set of data that can be fed into a model where it understands the relationships between data points? And, you know, having that framework there is actually going to put the mortgage industry ahead of, you know, other industries that don't have that, you know, that capability. So, and obviously there's a whole question around how much do we hand off to AI and how much do we leave in the hands of humans? And that's, you know, still got to work through that. But I do think that we're much better positioned to realize some of those gains because of, you know, some of the things that you're talking about. Even beyond that, you know, in 2025, there's a huge conversation around the 50 state regulator boogeyman, right? You know, yeah. The CFPB pulling back. What is this going to look like? And I'm sure there's, you know, real concern about that amongst a number of lenders. And so the fact that you all are working on this, you know, you mentioned the reception that you've seen from folks who can redeploy FTEs. I just think that's going to be very, very much in line with the sentiment of the industry in 2026. So I think that's super exciting.
Yeah, there's a great example that I would encourage the audience to go look at. Go to PennyMac's website. I don't know offhand exactly where it is, but they have some case studies around how they've built their internal data model at PennyMac on top of the foundation is the Mizmo standards, the Mizmo model. If I think about like the companies who are best poised to leverage AI, it'll be those companies that have taken a very intentional approach about building a sound foundation for how they manage data, because they're going to be able to fast track and test and fail faster than others, because they're already confident in their data model, their data structure. And I don't think that's limited to the big companies like PennyMac. I think, you know, a $500 million a year small IMB could take the same approach. It's just going to look a lot different at that scale. But I think that's if you want to leverage AI efficiently and use it as part of your you know, workflow management, you just have to have a handle around the data that's ultimately going into it.
100%, you know, spot on there. You know, what you're saying about whether it's, you know, a large lender or whether it's a small lender, the same opportunity is there, but it needs the data structure, you know, the clean, segmented, appropriately labeled, all of that needs to be there in order to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I was on a call yesterday and somebody was describing borrower name, that field, borrower name, and how many different derivations could exist with borrower name, right? Customer, consumer, first name, name first, last name, borrow, yep. You know, all the stuff, co-borrower.
Middle initial.
Yeah. And that's like a, every loan has that field, right? That information. So that's an example of a subset of a data standard, right? In the MISMO model, we've defined that borrower name, what it should be labeled everywhere across your tech stack, from pre-point of sale, call it CRM, into point of sale, into LOS, into your pricing and product engine, into closing service, all the way through. You know, that's the discipline you need to have as a data manager around how you look at all of the data components that ultimately are in your shop. And that's the power of what this community's done for 26 years, is taking the time to create those definitions and refine them and maintain them over time.
Right. And just helped the industry operationalize them across all the different, the growing list of tech platforms that we're all using. Right. So we've talked about a ton of good initiatives here and things that MISMO is focused on. And we talked a little bit about your recent conference a couple of weeks ago at Amelia Island, which is a gorgeous venue, by the way. I feel like there's a lot of conferences there and growing. Were there other themes either at the conference or just that you're thinking about going into 26 that are going to be super important for MISMO, but also just for our industry? Like what are people focused on? What should we be watching out for, preparing for?
Yeah, I think I'll veer off from a product or a program or a problem statement for a minute and really talk about what we believe and what our community believes needs to happen more. And that is we need more participation from industry in this MISMO community. I've seen that our industry employs somewhere around 350,000 humans, right, across the entire ecosystem. Yet at any given time, there might be 600 of those humans focused on, within the MISMO community, on big problems for industry. If we truly want to be better for the consumers that we all serve, we need to have more than 600 of us humans involved in this constant state of improvement through MISMO. You know, I'll use this as a call to action for the community, and the community is everybody, right? It's wherever you sit inside of a lender, you know, you have some subject matter expertise that we would love to have at our table helping us solve problems. If you're certainly on the tech and partner vendor side, you have another set of unique expertise that could be and is invaluable to the community. I've said it, there's six of us in MISMO proper. None of the six of us are active in these work groups. We're not the subject matter experts on capital markets, loan servicing, you know, compliance and legal. We help manage the process to bring these groups together. So we need the human capital participation, and we need economic participation, right? So again, shout out Optimal Blue. You all are active members and sponsors of MISMO, which means you're more than a sponsor of MISMO. You are a direct sponsor of the entire ecosystem by being involved the way you are, and that is greatly appreciated. We need lenders to understand the importance and value that they receive and they benefit from every day in their shop from MISMO. In mid-February, every lender will start to receive an innovation investment fee invoice, IIF, from MISMO. MERS is our partner, our billing partner, and they do some of the administrative work to deliver that invoice. But the IIF is a MISMO invoice. Every dollar through that IIF goes into MISMO and allows us to fund the work that happens in those 30 plus work groups, and also allows us to prepare for the next set of work that's coming down the pipe. So for lenders, please, when you get those invoices, if you have any questions, reach out to us at MISMO. You can hit me up on LinkedIn. Amy Moses is on LinkedIn. You can go to our MISMO.org website. We would love to hear from you if you have any questions when you get that invoice. This is a big year for the industry as we, again, move from that first inning in the AI game into the middle part of the game. And we need everybody participating. And that's how we're going to really advance this thing and ultimately best serve consumers and get to a place where we can actually lower the cost to manufacture alone, which is good for everybody in the ecosystem.
That's a great, great call to action. Great kind of thing for people to walk away with, I think, and think through. And as they do, you know, if I'm a lender, like, where do I start? How do I get involved?
Right. The best way to get involved is go to MISMO.org and navigate to, I think that it even says get involved or involvement. And
perfect.
There's a snapshot of the active work groups that exists today. Anybody can join a work group. We're open to the entire industry. We have some communities of practice that they're not quite working on a specific problem yet. Like the AI community of practice is this growing group of professionals that are having really meaty discussions around AI. And that's going to ultimately, there'll be some work groups that come out of that community of practice. The best way to get involved is to get involved. Find something that you're passionate about in your day-to-day work. You'll see it. It's going to be there in that in the website in our Life of Loan model. And just get involved. Join that work group. It's once a month, maybe an hour a month of your time to contribute.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that's a great message. And, you know, the industry is always changing, right? There's always things that are coming up and that we're going to need to solve for in the same way. We've talked about in this podcast, the rise of non-QM, you know, in the past year and all of the various types of non-QM, because, you know, non-QM is really an umbrella term that has a lot right. of, you know, nuance underneath it. All of these things need to be solved for. And it, you know, it takes folks, you know, stepping up and committing, you know, sometime, like you said, you know, an hour a month to join a work group that helped move it forward. I think that's a great message. You know, certainly love what you guys are doing. And, you know, like to bring it back to my original point, you know, if we didn't have, you know, the standards, we didn't have, you know, conventional mortgage, we'd have, you know, our Texas, you know, 30-year fix or California 30-year fix, right? They'd all be, and the rates would all be higher, you know,
yeah,
that, and that's, right. that's, you know, that's part of why having this centralized, you know, standards organization for the industry, centralized loan products, you know, all of this is, you know, helps us and is a lot, you know, day to day, maybe in the background a bit, but it's really underpinning everything that we're doing and a lot of the value that we can bring to the consumer.
Love it for sure.
Beautiful. I think we've grilled you pretty hard today, Brian, and so much appreciate you being generous with your time. This has been a great discussion for me. I mean, I had some light bulbs go off just doing research for this interview, but I think if just 4 months in, you're very knowledgeable and eloquent about how you explain what MISMO is doing. And again, appreciate you being on the pod today and spending time with us and dropping some wisdom on our listeners.
Appreciate it, guys. Again, thanks for all the support from Optimal Blue. We really appreciate the partnership.
Same to you.
Absolutely.
No, MISMO is a great partner of ours and we appreciate everything you guys are doing. All right. Thanks again, Brian. Thanks, Kevin. Great conversation. All right. Let's close this thing out. Thanks so much, everybody. Really good conversations today. A lot going on. Hopefully you're able to stick around for the whole podcast. Thanks, James and Alex, for talking through the recent Fed nomination and some of the market dynamics around that. Kevin, thank you for the interview with Brian and Brian View, of course. Thank you so much for joining us. Really good interview. I had a lot of fun talking with you. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.